Welcome to the Gottesdienst crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting.
Welcome back to the Gottesdienst crowd. This is Jason Broughton, your host. Today we have back with us Heath Curtis. He is the pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois, and Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois. Welcome back, Heath.
Thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
So I wanted to discuss with you today the goodness of being on a team. And it seems as though in our current climate and in our current culture, particularly men, they have gone away from operating as teams. They're either in competition with one another as a loner, or they're in competition with one another that doesn't really build each other up in the way like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn would, or in the way of Gilgamesh and Kidu, that their competition made one another stronger, and it put them into a nice hierarchy so that they could work better as a team. And it doesn't seem like we're operating in that manner today. And why is that?
Yeah, I guess we should speak most about what we know best. And so I'm going to speak from the position of a Lutheran clergyman. I do think this applies. I think what you say in general applies to men in general in America in general.
Yeah,
I do think there is, the forces of isolation and cutting out specifically male space. And all this is ground that I don't know if you've covered on your show before, but certainly it's been talked about a lot since, Putnam put out Bowling Alone. Mm-hmm. And, just the kind of decline of those. I think he's the one who coined the term, third spaces, places that are not home and they're not work. What else do you do with your life? And there used to be, card club and bowling and the VFW and the Elks Club and Lutheran Layman's League and all the other third places that you used to go to. And that's shrunk amazingly in American life. We could do more, big books on American culture. This is also kind of entertaining ourselves to death, that the demise of those third places is largely because I can do everything I want at home. All the major sports teams, even before the COVID craziness, were having problems selling tickets because why would I want to get in my car, drive to the game, spend $25 to park, walk 30 minutes to the stadium, sit there when I can sit at home, have my 70,000-inch TV, all my beverages at my elbow, my remote control that operates via my voice, et cetera, and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's there's a lot in that big discussion, but given the target audience of your podcast and my own life, I'm just going to approach this from my job as a Lutheran clergyman. And so the first thing is, I think building on the stuff from Putnam and other guys, is that this also applies to the clergy. I don't hang out with my colleagues in the ministry near as much as previous generations did. And I don't depend upon them for my social circle, I think, near as much as previous generations did. And this varies. My impression between me and my friends is that this varies in the different areas of the country that you serve in. But as you know, the natural grouping that we have in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is the Winkle, local pastor group that's typically between 7 to 20 congregations form a circuit. And then colloquially, this is called a Winkle from the old days when these groups would meet in a corner or a Winkle at the general pastor's conference. The guys within a certain radius of each other would, go and have their own meeting. And so these, typically we meet during the 9 months of the year that the kids are in school. I think most circuits in the Missouri Synod do this. And we get together And we're supposed to have a meeting. We have a little worship service, might be the divine service, might be matins. We have lunch together and discuss things. And I really like my Winkle. We've always gotten along well. We do those meetings, but we always feel rushed. We've never had a meeting where everybody's there. We do talk about some good topics. We've tried a couple times to get together for fun, to do more fun things, and all of us are busy. All of us are running in six different directions. We haven't made it a priority. And again, I'm in a good circuit. Yeah. What is your experience with your current circuit and in, you know, other places you've been connected?
Yeah, we
with?
Have a great circuit. I mean, I've only been in this circuit my entire time in the ministry. And, you know, just like you say, we only have seven congregations in our circuit, but even then we don't always have everyone there. And you think that would be easier. There are some times when we are all there. We do try to get together for some fun or social events, usually kind of a picnic in the summer.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I think you've stated it right. It always feels rushed. People always seem distracted while they're there. And while we do have some great conversations about how to interpret the Bible or how do we understand the things that are going on in the culture, and there is a general camaraderie among us, these are not necessarily all the people that I turn to or that I hang out with.
Do you guys do family events? Or is it pretty much, or is it just pastors and any kind of?
Well, our picnic is a family event, and that's about it.
Once a year, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think both of us, we both serve in the same state, and you know, districts side by side, they're very, very similar in makeup. In my travels for the stuff that I do for the synod with stewardship, I get to see, you know, guys across the country, and I know of circuits that do more. I certainly know of circuits that do less. And so my gut feeling is that, you know, yeah, that you and I serve in, you know, probably better than average circuits. And even that, you know, we both feel that there's, you know, something missing. You know, we hear stories of the, you know, generations before us that, you know, every month this was a huge thing. Everybody was there, you know, maybe every other month we brought the wife and kids. It was an all day affair. I think those places are fewer and farther between. Mm-hmm. So that's one angle to this. I think there's less time together. But again, you're talking about being on a team and being in competition. So now from there, I serve in one of the Lutheran dense areas of America. You know, there are these, obviously, if you're serving in the Northeast, there are very few Lutherans, very few congregations. That has a different feel to it. Then growing up where I grew up in, on the plains in Western Nebraska, lots of Lutherans, but just everybody's really spread out. That's a different kind of vibe, because where I'm at, you cannot swing a dead cat without hitting three Lutheran churches and four Lutheran schools. I mean, it's just, I'm in the greater, you know, St. Louis region. I'm on the Illinois side of St. Louis, and Lutherans are just thick on the ground. Missouri Synod Lutherans are thick on the ground, almost no ELCA, and there's just tons of us. So this, I was really intrigued when you asked for this topic, because I think about this a lot in my area about competition. Mm-hmm. It is very hard not to let those ideas creep into what you think, because it's a zero sum game, right? Here I am at my small Lutheran congregation, and a new family moves to the area. Well, there are five LCMS congregations in the area, and three of them are pastored by, you know, guys I'm really close to. And the other two, I like them and I like their congregation, but which one of us is going to get, you know, the new Lutheran family that just moved into town? So there's stuff like that. And we haven't even gotten into the kind of much more poisonous competition that can be on the clergy roster between guys who disagree about their vision for the future of Lutheranism. We haven't got to, you know, what does it mean when the congregation next to me looks very different than my congregation in terms of liturgical practice, communion practice? What do you do with confirmation? Again, I'm incredibly blessed to be in an area where we all get along. We all see things pretty much the same. Yeah, congregations have their own personalities. Congregations have, you know, some of them do things differently, but I have it easy, again, compared to areas where other areas I have served in different metro areas, Chicagoland, for example, where there was really serious disagreement and division. That adds a completely different level to this. So there are, so there's three different pressures on this notion of being on a team, working together. Are we even pulling on the same rope? If I feel like I look at your Lutheran congregation and it just looks nothing like mine, and we have very little in common, boy, that's tough. And then we've got competition between each other for membership. And again, I should have also said this, in a time when every denominational family is shrinking in America, that makes that competition for membership and working together very difficult. And then just, we don't see each other. We don't know each other as well. We don't lean on each other as colleagues. And what does it mean to be a colleague when you have congregations that are separate from one another? What does it mean that you're the pastor two towns over or just 3 or 4 miles over? So I don't know if that's a comprehensive diagnosis of the problem, but those are the things that came to my mind when, when you sent your email asking for this, I immediately thought, yes, that's a problem. Those are at least three angles about why the problem exists.
So you mentioned that, you know, in the past, they got together more regularly and it was a bigger event and it was more inclusive of the entire family. And I think sometimes we tend to think that it was easier then. And I think it depends on how we defined it being easy. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, maybe gas was cheaper, but oftentimes these are happening when they were riding horses or, you know, other types of things. Perhaps easier in the sense that there was less competition for your time. But what will it take to perhaps not go back to the golden age, quote unquote, but what will it take to reinvigorate that kind of mindset among our brothers in the ministry?
Yeah. Well, I'll give one example that I've heard from old guys, and I'm definitely not advocating this as a practice, but there was one liturgical piety that drove them together. And that was that back in the, let's say, mid 20th century, I think as late as, we'll talk about other evidence for this in a minute, but the pastor only communed at Winkle. Oh. Have you heard this?
I have heard this.
Yeah. So.
So this is actually real.
This is absolutely real. So we've come a long way in our liturgical practice of recovering normal Reformation era Lutheran liturgical practice. And this is a great example of why liturgical practice matters so much and creates effects that you may have not seen coming. So today in Lutheran service book, the rubric is very clear in the divine service that the pastor communes himself and his assistants first. Mm-hmm. But there was a piety in certainly at least mid 20th century Lutheranism, I don't know how far back it goes, that the pastor should not commune himself. That this was, you know, maybe it felt papist. Maybe it felt, I know you can't baptize yourself, can't absolve yourself. Is it really okay to give yourself communion? Maybe that was part of it, right? I don't know. But it was very, very real. I had a pastor in my youth who was, you know, a couple, three generations older. I mean, he was in his late 80s. And this just would have been to him anathema. And at the same time, there was, in mid-20th century Lutheranism, it would have equally felt wrong to have a lay person commune you. The movement to have lay people assist with the distribution of the sacrament is, pretty late coming. Again, I haven't read any, good historical studies of this, but again, based on my anecdotal evidence of talking to these guys and based on their ages and stuff, I'm going to say it's really not till, I think it's a Vatican II thing. I think Vatican II ushered into not only Roman Catholicism, but Lutheranism, Methodism, Anglicanism, this huge lay liturgical movement. And so let's just say, for the sake of argument, that before 1965, lay people were just not assisting with the sacrament. So the pastor could not commune except at Winkle, where he could go to the circuit meeting and the host pastor would have the communion service and then all the preachers could take communion together. And again, I think that was a false piety. Those guys were being pious. They were trying to be pious, but I think it was an ill-informed piety. And I rejoice that as a synod, we've recovered, Reformation era practice. And, the normal thing is right there on the page in LSB. That's wonderful. But there you go. That did drive them to want to be together. And so maybe what we need to, and I know this is a topic that you guys have explored quite a bit, both in print and live presentations on this podcast, is do we really think we need to hear sermons? Right?
Yeah.
Do we really think we need to receive absolution? Writing sermons is fun. Delivering sermons is fun. I think most guys who, survive in the ministry to actually make it, into their career, you survive 5 or 6 years in the ministry, you probably like preaching and you're probably pretty good at it. But do you think you need to hear sermons? Can you listen to a sermon without just being, can you actually be a person who needs to receive the word and not just sit over in competition and judge your brother for the for the way he's handling the text?
Right.
And so maybe this is a way to recover, because we need, like you said, it's, I don't think it was necessarily easier for guys in 1975 or 1955 to get together for Winkle. It was probably just as difficult. They were just as busy, if not more busy, than you and I are. But they had, as part of their piety, man, I need to go to Winkle because I need to receive communion. How about I need to go to Winkle because I need to sit in the pew. I need to hear the word read to me and preached to me. Maybe that would be a place to start to encourage us to get together better.
Yeah. What else is Winkle for besides that? I mean, there are other things that happen there that are necessary for building us up. Do we even see being on a team as necessary anymore?
Yeah. I want to take that idea of building each other up and what that means. Sometimes it's just straight up encouragement. I think that's what that term means in colloquial English. If I'm going to colloquial Christian English, if I'm going to build you up, it means that, I'm going to say encouraging words to you and whatnot. But I think the times that I have been most blessed in my experience, again, being in a good Winkle, is we're talking about, some difficult issue. Controversial issue either that's come up in our Winkle or that the church at large is dealing with, or a societal issue, and to hear another brother articulate, it always comes down to the other brother is articulating, guys, we need to do the right thing. And maybe, and often, that's after another brother has kind of said something kind of wavering. Well, maybe we could. And then another guy's like, no, here's why we need to stick to our guns. And and to hear that aspect of being on a team, again, a constant controversy within not only our denomination, I think, but any denomination that practices, biblical closed communion, I'm sure priests and diocese Roman Catholic diocese have similar discussions, there's always a temptation to let something slide or to not, you know, teach this as vigorously as it could. I mean, so there's a just a common thing that gets talked about a lot at Winkles, I think. And unfortunately, in some of those really conflicted Winkles where congregations are just completely at odds with each other, can be very destructive. But if you're in, you know, a group of guys that, you know, are teaching together what your synod teaches, it's really important to hear that. But it's not only that issue. It could be on any number of issues, something that's been controversial locally or, one of the brothers, elders, are giving him a hard time on whatever topic. It's just good to hear the other. So building somebody up is not just, we're not a mutual admiration society. It's looking each other in the eyes and hearing another guy, you know, say, you know, I just think you need to stick to your guns. It's going to be okay. We got your back. So it's not, you know, oh, you're such a good pastor. It's actually, you know, we're going to be on your team. We'll stand with you. We're doing the same thing. We're fighting the same battles. I know sometimes it stinks. Those are probably the things that I've enjoyed most in Winkle. And right up behind that would be, I just learned things from these guys when we have, because not everybody is equally as well read on different topics and in different areas. So, in our Winkle, I end up reading a lot of old systematic theology because I do, you know, some assistant editing for CPH for the John Gerhardt volumes. So, you know, I bring that to the table. But there's another guy in my Winkle, sadly, who's leaving us for Nebraska, who is like the most well-read guy on modern, you know, contemporary, you know, deep thinking literature that's connected to, you know, just, you know, thinking American culture. Man, he'll pull stuff out and quote stuff that I don't read. I don't have I don't have the time to do that. I'm certainly not doing it. And then there's, you know, the guy who's, you know, been doing this for 30 years and he's got his ideas and experience to draw on that, you know, a lot of us, I mean, we haven't been near as much around the block as he has. So that, again, one thing that makes you a team is that people are bringing different strengths, you know, whatever team you're talking about in sports, right, there's specialization. And it's the same with Winkle Brethren.
Yeah. You mentioned about when there are disagreements and discussion, when that takes place, it seems as though we have an expectation that in our discussions, there would be no disagreement. And that we have an expectation that it would just be like a cheerleading party. Of building up. And so our expectations going in are wrong instead of thinking that someone else might have something else to say that I could benefit from. And even just a lack of that kind of mindset can be destructive for actually being a team in the place where you are.
Yeah. I call this the union problem, and the problem is we don't think of ourselves as a union. So here's my example. This happened to me early in my ministry here in this circuit with a brother who is now singing in the choir Immortal, and so again he's you know solid two generations older than me, old enough to be my grandpa, and we did not share a vision for the future of Lutheranism. And one day at the Winkle, this was in the days when many of us were working toward reversing the 1989 Wichita lay ministry stuff. And, you know, thankfully that all happened. We were talking about this in Winkle, and this brother, who was also the circuit counselor, because they were circuit counselors at the time, not circuit visitors. He was circuit counselor. And, you know, I said my piece and, you know, I was sub 30 at the time and I probably said it more abrasively than I could have said it. But then he got hot because he was at Wichita in 1989 and made sure to tell us all that. And why, you know, this is why we did this. And I mean, I mean, I don't think I raised my voice, but I don't have to raise my voice to be, you know, a very, you know, incisive jerk, right? So I think I was yeah. kind of an incisive jerk, and tempted him to lose his temper, and he did. And it was very clear that, you know, we were not getting along. Well, lo and behold, here a few months later, the district had mandated that the DP visit all the congregations, pastors and board elders. But then they gave him the out, of course. I mean, that's a lot of congregations. And so they gave him the out that he could, I don't know, you know, delegate half of this to the circuit visitors and vice presidents or something. And well, mine was one of the congregations that got delegated to the circuit counselor. So I'm like, oh, great. So like we just had this, you know, this row at Winkle. And he's going to come, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. You know, the old guy is going to come in, old experienced guy, and just kind of pick me apart. And so I'm just dreading this. He came into that meeting, and he was professional and complimentary. And, you know, you guys are, it's great to see that you guys have got a young, energetic pastor here. You know, what's been going on in the past? How do you think, you know, Pastor Curtis can help you? What can the district do for you? And that right there, that is, if we're going to be team players, if we're all going to be on the same team, you got to be able to treat everybody, on the ministry roles the way that he treated me. I mean, we had a substantive theological difference, but we were on the same union. And so when it came to, you know, to keep this metaphor going, when it came to being with the management, he was on my side. He was on my team. Even though we had a substantive theological disagreement, and even though we had had words, and it was very emotional, that made a huge impression on me. And mm-hmm. I have tried to maintain that same kind of professionalism and viewing, you know, my brothers in the ministry, even those with whom I have disagreements, we're in the same union. And you are never going to have to fear from me that I'm going to do anything sneaky behind your back to hurt you and your ministry. Because in a way that is more intense for pastors than many other lines of work, if you hurt me at work, you are hurting my family.
Yeah,
and my potential for to earn a livelihood in the future. I mean, we all know horror stories of a brother in the ministry gets a black mark on his paperwork and gets a reputation for X, Y, and Z, and things can be very difficult for him. And so, I've really tried to emulate that great example that brother showed me.
So, is that just part of distinguishing between what we talk about in private among ourselves and then how we like parents, mom and dad, they may have a heated disagreement in the bedroom when the kids are asleep. But if dad made a bad decision, mom's going to back up dad. And if mom made a bad decision, dad's going to back up mom in front of the kids, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's how this mindset often is instantiated in reality, mm-hmm. but it's got to be more than just that procedure of I'm not going to disagree with you in front of your own laity. I think that's true, but you got to ask yourself, what's behind that? So in the marriage, what's behind that is, mom and dad love each other. They got married for a reason. And what's behind it for us really needs to be that I really do need to see that brother, even if I disagree with him, that we're on the same team, we're in the same union, we are, doing the same work. And all the things we talked about beforehand, these obstacles to us working for a team, I get it. It's tougher if you're in an area where the brothers really are severely divided over important issues, and it comes down and it affects membership and transfers back and forth. And so we could get down to a lot more specifics about also kind of, what are the rules of the road for transfers in a Lutheran heavy area. Mm-hmm. But I think it's pretty clear how those things would would work out. But I want to talk about two different things when it comes to being on a team.
Okay.
Can I hijack your interview? Do you have any more super insightful questions?
No.
Perfect.
I mean, I just, as they come out, that's how it works here.
Right. So, and I also want this to be like a preview. We were talking before we hit the record button that I want to talk about another aspect of this in another day, but I want to do the prescription before the diagnosis.
Okay.
So for what it's worth, here's what I would prescribe to every Lutheran pastor. Maybe we'll just tease this out for, and then in a future podcast, I'll explain why I think these two things are important. Every pastor needs a hobby, and every pastor needs to get in shape. I think those two things would help our pastorate, oddly enough, in this aspect of being a team player and in many other things. And I'll talk a little more than a tease now about why I think these two things are so. And they're both for the same reason. So I serve in, you know, small town, rural Illinois. And what reminded me a lot of where I grew up in southwestern Nebraska, in that what strikes me about small town, isolated life, there's good, bad, and ugly. But one of the things that really impresses me about the people who choose to live this kind of life is their universal competence, mm-hmm. right? So if you're from a town of 1,200 people or 2,000 people or whatever, everybody in the town, the people in the town have to take care of everything important. And so when you call 911, it's your neighbors who show up, right? Yeah. The ambulance guys just go to your church. The township board is all people you know. So the guys who, and again, this is crazy to me. There are no experts who build roads in a rural township, Illinois. It's just all guys you know, and mm-hmm. they have to learn how to build roads. This is crazy to me, right? As a, you know, very white collar, no calluses on my hand, preacher type guy, right? That these guys can just do everything. This is, I think, here's where I think this ties into being the team player thing, is that backbiting and the desire to fight and show yourself in kind of passive aggressive, especially competition with your brothers in ministry, that's a lack of confidence in yourself, right? So again, that mm-hmm. story I told about my circuit visitor who had a disagreement with me but could come into my elders and be totally supportive. That can't happen unless he has a huge amount of confidence in himself and his own ministry, right? That's not the guy who comes in and berates you. The guy who comes in and berates you and kind of says sly things behind your back and all that, that's the guy who isn't confident enough to confront you himself. And so he does these. Okay. So this is my theory. And so I think we need to build confidence in the ministry, and it shouldn't be fake confidence.
Yeah.
It should be confidence that comes from competence, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the two best ways for you to gain a sense of yourself, because again, you got through seminary, you know that you have competence in certain areas, but let's face it, those competences, Pastor Broughton, what do they call the guy who got through seminary and he got a D in Hebrew and he got a C in theology and he got a C minus in preaching? What do they call him?
When he gets out?
Yeah.
They call him pastor.
Exactly. They call him pastor. there is a sense to where, okay, yeah, we made it through seminary, but you know, it's a bar you have to get over, and you have to get over it. And maybe some of us, I mean, I think all of us come out of seminary and vicarage, maybe not so sure of ourselves. So we've got some expertise. But you were also, you know, thrust at 28 years old, thrust into a leadership position in a church, in a community. And probably, you know, most of us are just then getting married, having kids, you know, lots coming at you fast. And I think every man needs to build that confidence, which has to come from competence, right? You can fake it till you make it, and you have to, but yeah. You do want to make it. And so that's one. And then two, another reason I think we lack confidence is because the competencies that we have developed are not necessarily widely viewed as awesome, amazing things, right? So you talk for a living, huh?
Yeah, indeed. They're often looked down upon.
For sure. Well, if your heart, I think you're lying if you say your heart doesn't sink every time one of your parishioners or just, you know, somebody you met at the local bar or library says, well, yeah, okay, pastor. Yeah, okay. Thank you for quoting that Bible verse to me, but, you know, it's all a matter of interpretation. Oh, well, that's my whole life. And that's what I'm supposed to be good at. So in a different day and age when, the society at large universally supports and admires the clergy, maybe this wasn't such a big deal. It therefore led to other problems. I mean, I love the portrayals of especially English clergy in English novels from, you know, Jane Austen down to P.D. James and Agatha Christie mystery novels. You know, always have, you know, the poor vicar and curate. I think they had their issues in their day as well. But you need to develop competence so that you can have confidence. And so especially – go ahead.
Go ahead.
As you say, especially it needs to be – so when I say – so the first step is get a hobby.
Yeah.
And a hobby is – a hobby has to be doing something, not knowing something.
Yeah.
And this is a big problem for pastors. We think that knowing something – is important or a hobby. It's good, it's certainly important. But I'm talking about knowing everything about baseball. I'm talking about joining a wooden bat league for guys over 30.
Yeah.
Or I'm not talking about knowing everything about every microbrewery within a 100-mile radius of your house. I'm talking about actually getting into brewing the beer.
Yeah.
So it can be, your hobby can be anything. Literally anything you're interested in, but it has to be something that you actually do.
Yeah, there's a really great book by Matthew Crawford called Shop Class as Soul Craft. Have you heard of this book?
I think I've heard you mention it, but yeah, I haven't read it yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, he, University of Chicago, trained, I think he has a PhD in like public policy, worked for think tanks out in Washington, D.C., and, you know, he was going to change the world because he had a PhD and he knew everything. But all of that was already decided for him, what the policy was going to be. He just was the researcher to write it up.
Right.
And what he chose to do instead is to open up a motorcycle shop to work on motorcycles, because that's what he did to put himself through University of Chicago. And he said, you know, I meet these guys who worked on motorcycles and they're far more competent in life than all of the guys in the PhD program or all of the people in Washington, D.C. Because not only did they have to look at a problem, but they actually had to find where it was and then actually fix it so that the thing worked.
Yeah.
And all these other guys are just living in their heads all day.
Yep. And this also it also introduces you to what healthy competition is like. So the easiest way to do that is to get into some sport.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, tennis is great for old men. I play tennis now against a bunch of other old men. And there's camaraderie there and there's friendly competition. And you learn that to compete with someone also means that you're kind of rooting for them to get better. But I also want to say, though, that this is not a, we're starting to veer into both the secular and the Christian manosphere topics now, right? Mm-hmm. And because there's obviously a strongly felt need in our society for, the loss of male space, of the manly virtues. And again, I want to have another podcast where if you'll have me back, where we'll talk about that in some more detail. But I want to make sure to mention here that this is not about get more macho.
Yeah.
I give the example of another Goddess Saints bro. So Will Whedon and I served, you know, across the, until he took the job at Synod and now doing full-time stuff with Lutheran Public Radio. Our congregations, we can hear each other's church bells. And so we worked very closely together. And we're very different in our personalities. You know, he one time at a meeting we were at said, yeah, you know, Pastor Curtis is Esau and I'm Jacob, right? I was probably talking about hunting or something. It's like, you know, I'm a man who sits in the tent, you know?
Yeah.
But nobody who's met Will Whedon would say he lacked confidence or competence or was a man's man. I'm not saying be less bookish.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, you know, if you got into the ministry, you probably are a very bookish guy. But I'm saying you can't be only a bookish guy who only collects information, collects facts without, you know, doing something out in the world that changes the world. In fact, I'd even go so far to say this. So I said, you know, a hobby is not knowing everything about beer, it's brewing beer. I would even say, if you really want to be into, you know, archaeology, it's not a hobby until you volunteer with your local university to go do a dig, mm-hmm. or until you become, you know, a real amateur in the true sense of the word, as it was coined in the Victorian age, that you, you know, write an article. Like, yeah. So words can absolutely be a hobby, but they have to be something you actually do and produce, not merely something you absorb. So I'd even say it's not just knowing everything about Walt Whitman, but it's getting a poem published in American Poetry. Yeah. That counts, right? That's a hobby. So developing competence via a hobby, and this it just has tons of other benefits for pastors in general. All the benefits that go with relaxation and having something else that you can think about, I think go double for a pastor's need for stress reduction because we live so much between our ears.
Yeah. So you're saying it's not a passive thing. It's an active thing that you're building a skill, whether it's woodworking or, as you said, some sort of sport. It's not just something that you passively take in as you read about it and then you become knowledgeable about it, but it's something that you actually put into practice.
Yeah, that you create, mm-hmm. you know, that you create and change the world in some way with your actions. That's what makes it a hobby. And then this goes into the second one, and that is, I think it's really important for preachers to get in shape, not because like I'm shilling for Concordia Health Plans to bring down all of our premiums, although that would be great, but because I think this is why when St. Paul talks about sanctification, these are the metaphors he uses, right? Mm-hmm. He uses the metaphors of athletics and military service, and both of them are about. So you want to change yourself, right? I mean, this is what sanctification is about. You want to work with the Holy Spirit and the powers he's given you to grow more and more in your faith in Christ. How are you going to say no to spiritual temptations when you can't say no to the extra piece of cake?
Yeah.
How are you going to, right? This gets into all kinds of, we can see this all through Christian, you know, I think medieval Christian practices that we would condemn, that you know, there's certainly aspects of this to the various ascetic movements within Christianity that Lutherans, I think, would rightly look askance at, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. If you want to develop competence, there's, and I bet everybody listening can think of somebody in their life who's, just became a different person when they got rid of some terrible habit, or got themselves in physical shape. And what you saw there was the creation of confidence through competence. Mm-hmm. You know, I applied myself. A guy, again, that I've serves halfway across the country. I see him once a year at a conference, And so, you know, I come back, you know, 1 year to this conference, and there he is, and he is always a funny guy, always a great guy. Loved hanging out with him. Smart, good pastor. And he comes back 1 year, and he's seriously shed like 100 pounds.
Wow.
And I'm just like, man, what happened? You know, what did you do? And he was the same funny. He's the same smart. He's the same good guy. But there is just a different look in his eye, right? And a different way he walked around the room. And it's not because, right, all of a sudden he's Brad Pitt, right? It's right. It's not even about numbers on a scale or numbers in the weight room. It is about he set a goal for himself, and he did it. Mm-hmm. That is huge. And the truth of the matter is, dealing with that physical reality is easier than conquering my temper, right? Is easier than conquering my lust. So it seems like, you know, this is kind of the reason why we give things up in Lent, right? Because we're practicing on the easy stuff, so that hopefully, you know, this makes us, you know, hopefully it'll have some effect on us doing the big stuff. And I'll finish his story. I'm like, man, what was the big plan? You know, what did you do? He says, I eat the same 3 meals every single day. And so that was perhaps an extreme version of what I'm talking about. You know, the absolute application of competence to a situation is like, all right, this is the nutrient balance I need every day. Why change it? Let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
This is, this kind of mental fortitude is a big topic. You said in the Manosphere, you know, anywhere from what Jocko Willink or David Goggins, you know, these Navy SEAL types who come out and just say, look, it's like 90% mental. And if you can...
Well, and for those guys, and Cameron Haynes too. Cameron Haynes has a new book.
Oh, that's right.
And, he's been around, and I like that guy because he's a hunter, right? But for all those guys, Jocko and Cameron, you know, it's 90% mental and 85% steroids. So we don't want to give them, you know, we don't give them too much credit. I like the guys in that, you know, fitness realm who are brutally honest. You know, one of them. Oh gosh, he was on. He got his start doing crazy stunts on TV.
Joe Rogan.
No. Joe Rogan is very honest about it too. But this is the quote I'm going to give is from Juji Mufu. And he was on American Ninja Warrior and all this stuff. And he did a video and talking about his, you know, nutrition and everything. And somebody criticized the video for saying, "Hey man, yeah, of course you're recovering. You're obviously on gear." And, you know, don't give us the impression. And he commented and he said, listen, I didn't mean to give that impression. My video is about general nutritional stuff. But of course, yeah, I'm as natural as your microwave. So I'm definitely have some advantages. And that's a good segue into, you know, hopefully you and I can do another hour where we, because I want to take up one of these big topics that's going to link back to your idea of being on a team, and that is how do men relate to each other in different contexts. And you mentioned the word hierarchy, and this is, of course, Luther's big concept for Christian vocation, is that we exist in three different hierarchies. And all through the Bible, we have examples of men in different hierarchies, and how do they work together, and how do they fit in. And I think the general interest in the past decade in, out in the world of the Christian manosphere, I wish there was a less stupid name for this, but I think there's been some good stuff said. But again, there's also a lot of, you know, junk out there because, the joke in the fitness community is all these, you know, actors who go out and, you know, they get ripped for this. For this big role, they're going to play a superhero or whatever. And how'd you do it? Well, I worked out 7 days a week and I ate chicken and rice. And so the joke is that chicken and rice is code for steroids, right? So there's a lot of fakeness to it. You know, just like anything else we're learning from the world, we need to filter it through a Christian lens and really ask ourselves, what's biblical here, what's not, what's true here, what's not, what's helpful, what's not. And so, yeah, next time I'd like to talk about that. You know, what can we learn from what others are saying? You know, guys like Jordan Peterson, right, said very interesting things. And again, his career has gone very wonky and weird, but very interesting things about how is it that men fit together in hierarchies. What does it mean? So there's been a lot of thinking out there, and I think that'd be a beneficial conversation for pastors to think about. What's my role in all the different vocations I have? How can I fulfill that role? What's expected of me in that role? What's my kind of natural role that I prefer? For example, we all know guys who, there's no way they would ever want to serve at a big church where there's more than one pastor. Mm-hmm. And we know guys who are like, yeah, I really enjoy this role as associate pastor and the buck stops on another guy's desk.
Yeah.
Well, that tells you something about yourself, but you don't always get to pick, right? So for example, in your family, you don't get to pick, I'm first officer and my wife is captain. You don't get to pick that. You know, the Bible says something different. And likewise, when you walk into a situation when you're dealing with your brothers in Christ in the ministry, there are going to be situations where you don't get to choose to be captain, and maybe you don't even get to choose to be Commander Riker. Maybe you have to be, down in engineering in a red shirt, ready to be sent to your death.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. And I do hope we can schedule the time to talk about those things. Any final thoughts?
No, being on a team is okay. Here's the final thought. It's not optional. So even if we're, even if we, to get back to where we started this conversation, even if we realize we're not good at it and we realize maybe less than previous generations, we don't actually live out and embody this team aspect of the ministry and with the congregations around us, we are still a team. So we're running away from our responsibilities, but the outside world views us this way, and what I do affects your ministry and vice versa, and we can't run away from it. So we do need to tackle it, and hopefully this conversation is a start to get guys to think about how they might do that.
Great. Thanks for your time, Heath, and I look forward to that future conversation.
All right. Thanks, Jason.